Welcome to our podcast on unpacking development in the world. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy for Leadership, which is known by its German acronym IAF. Located in the German town of Gummersbach, the Academy trains leaders working for partner organizations of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom all over the world. It brings together experts, opinion leaders, committed young liberals, and aspiring leaders to share their specific experiences and knowledge and to develop liberal solutions to public policy challenges. In today's episode, we pick up the complex topic of unpacking development, which means we want to look at ways how to define and then also measure development. And we also look at how this development process can be supported, how effective are different approaches to promote development. To answer these difficult questions, we have with us an expert on the matter. It is Lan Pritchett. Lan Pritchett is a development economist from Idaho. He received his PhD in economics from MIT in 1988. Then he worked for the World Bank from 88 to 2007, living in Indonesia, 1998 to 2000, and in India, 2004 to 7. He taught at the Harvard Kennedy School from 2000 to 2019 and was intermittently the faculty chair of the MPA ID degree program. From 2018 to 23, he was the research director of the RISE program at Oxford's Blavatnik School of Government. Having now thrice retired, he is currently a visiting professor at the London School of Economics in the School of Public Policy and a co-founder and research director of Labour Mobility Partnerships. Land has published over 100 works with over 50 co-authors. His work spans a range of development topics, including economic growth, state capability, basic education, labour mobility, development assistance, and so much more. He has been at times influential, and his publications have been cited over 50,000 times. It is good to have you with us today, Land. Thanks for joining us on this podcast.
Happy to be here.
We want to discuss this concept of human development. We want to discuss, you know, what is growth and how should we actually measure it? We have a whole range of questions. And we have worked as a practitioner, but you've also, of course, have worked as an academic looking at it from a broader perspective. So let's look at maybe first, how do we define development? How do we define and measure development? Maybe looking at that first, and then later we can have a look at, you know, development support, aid or support, whatever you want to call it. So let's start maybe with a range of questions looking at development itself. Okay. And I know that people sometimes either just use development and economic growth interchangeably.
Mm.
And sometimes people make quite a bit of an emphasis on one of the terms. They believe this one is better than the other.
Yeah.
What is your take on this? I mean, does it for you not matter whether we talk about economic growth or development or these two different concepts?
I think there's a big distinction between national development and what is often discussed as human development. And I think economic growth is subsumed under my category of national development. So let me clarify those two things. First, the word development intrinsically means some dynamic process whereby something becomes more like the thing it is. So an acorn develops into an oak, a tadpole develops into a frog. But you don't change what we would call ontological categories. An acorn doesn't become a frog. Now, if you ask me, what does development mean to me? Development is a process of nations, of countries, of societies, to the extent those overlap. And so I think the process of national development is a fourfold transformation of a country. And it's a transformation to higher productivity. And that's one way of describing economic growth. But it's also a transformation of the polity, to where the polity, the people who control the sovereign power of the country, become more responsive to their citizens. So there's a transition from state-controlling subjects to citizens controlling the state. There's a third process of the enhanced capability of the state and its organizations to carry out their purposes, which is what I call state capability. And lastly, is sort of transformation of kind of identities to where there's equal treatment of all the citizens within the country. You might still affiliate with some tribe or ethnicity or kith or clan, but that gets subsumed into this the assumption that every citizen gets treated equally before the law. Again, this isn't an elimination of multiple identities, but there is this overriding national identity. So I think that fourfold process is what I mean by national development. I think it's what, you know, development was born essentially out of decolonization. And I think in the process of decolonization, the early leaders saw what their countries were going to do was going to become equal players on the world stage with their former colonial taskmasters. And so I think most people conceived of what was going to happen post-independence was a national process or a country process. And it had those four features. And there can be debates at the margins about what exactly each of those four features mean. And I try and use functional rather than institutionally descriptive terms. So I didn't say democracy. I said a responsive polity. And I said state capability. I didn't say bureaucracy. So sometimes we've confused instantiations with concepts and functional. So I try and functional descriptions. Now, the assumption was that national development would lead to human beings having more flourishing and prosperous, and lives would be better in a variety of ways. And so the national development process, I think, for most people was never seen as intrinsically desirable. It was a means to an end, that if we achieved a country that had a more productive economy, a more capable state, a more responsive polity, and a more equal treatment of its citizens, that would be a set of processes and resource generation that would create high levels of human well-being. Mm. Now some people refer to human development, and I think that's just ontologically a different thing. So I can go into a country and I can say, how many years of schooling do people in this country have? And it's an individuated measure that can be aggregated to the country level, but it's not intrinsically and ontologically a country level feature. It's not a characteristic of a country. So I could also go into Nepal and say, what's the education of left-handed people and right-handed people? Mm-hmm. But the left-handed and right-handed isn't an intrinsic feature, right? Mm-hmm. So I make a strong distinction between national development and its and then we can measure from individual or whatever level measures, we can measure human well-being directly. But I think of the causal process was we thought, and I continue to think strongly because I think the evidence supports it, that if you accomplish national development, it is a machinery that endogenously through its normal operation generates good outcomes on human well-being.
That's very interesting. So it's two distinct processes, but there's a causality. They are interrelated.
Exactly.
But we should be clear what we are talking about.
Exactly. And I think this is important when we get to say talk about aid. You know, you can imagine you're going to just go in and raise human well-being without affecting national development, and you can do it to some extent. But that's not, in my mind, development work. Development work, if it's about national development, is about these four underlying transformational processes that, you know, I coined with my friend Michael Wilcott the phrase that development is about getting to Denmark. And what do we mean by that? Well, first we chose Denmark because it's innocuous. Very few people have strong feelings about Denmark. Maybe Germans do, but most people don't. But it's just sort of Denmark is a prototypical high productivity economy, clearly, you know, highly responsive polity. There's not some small elite or individual king that controls what the government does. Clearly highly capable bureaucracies that are capable of carrying out education and policing and other things. And clearly equal treatment. If you're a Dane, you're a Dane. And equal treatment before the law is the natural thing. So again, that process, I think, is important, and I'm emphasizing it these days more because I think many development organizations and institutions have lost their way. I think they've gotten confused thinking they can achieve, there's another pathway to high levels of human well-being that doesn't go through national development. And I think because I think the evidence shows this, that's wrong.
That's very interesting that you bring up that point that development institutions have lost their way, because development institutions in general also rely on what development economists or development academia brings to the table as evidence of this is what we should put forward. And that evidence really strongly relies on the data that you collect.
Right.
So what are the measures that are out there to measure, actually reliably measure these kind of four characteristics that you're talking about in national development? Are there reliable data measures out there for us to be concretely able to say that here's the evidence that supports this kind of a theory?
So I think, I am an economist. I think as economists, we have built GDP and we have built out gross domestic or gross national product, and there are slight distinctions throughout the world. And I think those are reliable indicators of what they're meant to measure. Gross domestic product is meant to measure the country's overall value added. And it's not directly a measure of human well-being, and no economist has ever been confused that national accounting is a direct and sufficient measure of human well-being, but it is a measure of the productivity of your economy. And so I think that's been extensive. I think it's there are enormous numbers of complex questions, but to the purposes to which it's put, it's roughly reliable. Mm-hmm. Meaning, if I say GDP grew 2% and you say it grew 2.3%, yeah, sure, maybe we're wrong. Mm-hmm. But if we say Nepal is in this category of countries and Denmark is in that category of countries, we're never badly wrong about that. Now, about the other dimensions, I think we have more contestation about how to measure them, in part because they don't have an intrinsic metric. You know, the reason economics is there's a natural cardinal metric. Prices give us, prices are in units, and they're in units that we can add up. And to some extent, our aggregation problems are simple, because how do you add up apples and oranges? By their price, and there's the total value of fruit. Measuring a response of polity, that's much harder, because it could well be you have a government that wasn't elected but is highly responsive. It may well be you have a government that is elected, but it's elected on a very narrow basis that excludes many people. Is that really fully responsive? Now, there's lots of measures of democracy. I think democracy we measure pretty well. Responsive polity, again, there are a number of measures. I think some of them are pretty reliable. State capability, I think there are reasonable aggregate measures of, say, can this country adequately control corruption? Again, corruption is hard to measure, but you can measure, there are measures of bureaucratic effectiveness. A lot of these are subjective and built up from expert surveys. Again, I think they're reasonably reliable, not to compare fine distinctions. But again, if you say, if I say Denmark has more state capability than Portugal has more state capability, than Dominican Republic has more state capability, than India has more state capability, than South Sudan, I don't think anybody's going to really dispute that ranking. Now, if we start comparing, Chile and Argentina, I don't know. So I think, broadly speaking, I think there are good indicators. And from my point of view as an empirical economist, one of the things that tells me indicators are reliable is if they have reasonable associations with things I think they should have associations with. So a recent research I did that was published looked at determinants of human well-being as a function of GDP per capita, state capability, and democracy, and it gives really reasonable answers. So I think one measure of reliability for purpose is, gee, if I think state capability should be closely correlated with this other thing, is it? And if it isn't, I can question the reliability of the measure more than if it is.
But just to clarify here on the point you made earlier, in the first response when you were describing development, you made this distinction between national development, the agenda, post-colonial agenda that development agencies thought about, and there's a distinction between human flourishing in that sense, right? But now you're saying there is a connection on things that actually lead to national development lead to human flourishing. Exactly. Is that how I understand?
Yes, but I think that's a causal connection, not a necessary connection. It's not a definitional thing, meaning I can define national development and I can define and measure human development, and the empirical strength of that relationship is an open empirical question. Again, the hypothesis on which the post-colonial agenda was built was that, you know, countries that got better in these four dimensions were going to be more adequately able to deliver on human well-being. Mm-hmm. I think that has proved to be robustly true. and so whereas people might doubt the development process, I think that's more skepticism, I think, about the means than whether of accomplishing those objectives, meaning we can have huge debates about what will lead to economic growth of various types that benefit various groups. But I think the data shows just incontrovertibly that if you achieve high levels of productivity, that is just nearly always associated with higher levels of human well-being across a wide variety of fronts in the way we would expect it to be. If people have higher productivity in the economic sense, that gives them more resources. They spend those resources on things they care about, they get better off. It's like, it would be hard. It's hard for me to imagine a world in which that weren't true.
Let me share a hypothesis, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this. Your four criteria that, or four components in a way that you shared earlier, reminded me of Douglas North and violence and social orders. So he basically says it's all about coming from a coalition that dominated access to resources, political as well as economic, and it's a path towards an open access, equal access to resources, political and economic, as well. So we see, and in a way, I saw this a little bit behind what you were sharing earlier. Now, I want to throw in the idea of economic freedom here now.
Yes.
So we have talked about from GDP, how GDP relates to human flourishing. Now we would have like an economic freedom of the world report that would say economic freedom leads to GDP growth and leads to human flourishing. So basically, they also claim a causality.
Yeah,
there are people, some people would say it's just a correlation, etc. So what's your take on this?
First of all, I think the evidence going from the realization of higher levels of GDP to higher levels of human well-being is, like I say, I think I've been writing papers recently because it's begun to be questioned, but I think that connection is incontrovertible. I mean, the association between physical indicators like malnutrition, like child mortality, access to infrastructure like water and sanitation and GDP is just hugely strong, a very strong relationship. So that, I think, now, I think where more of the debate happens is what's instrumental to higher levels of GDP per capita. I tend to believe the evidence shows that some modicum of economic freedom is in fact necessary to generate high levels of economic productivity. There's some debate because I think you can drive certain very basic levels from, if you move from anarchy to an ordered existence that denies a lot of freedom, that can still make a lot of progress. So you can have economic growth at low levels to higher levels without a ton of economic freedom. I mean, you know, we can't deny that Russia, in going from, you know, its barbarous, horrific methods, did create an industrial power that was capable of, you know, fighting World War II. So there are stages of economic development in which one can debate how much economic freedom is needed, but certainly to reach high levels of economic productivity, I think you really need economic freedom, A. B, I also think there is a direct connection between human flourishing and economic freedom, in the sense that I think I'm a huge believer in freedom. And I think if you don't have economic freedom, you really don't have an important component of freedom. I'm always, you know, so I think, you know, a Chinese scholar one time told me that Deng's reforms weren't about economic freedom. They weren't about property rights. They were about rights to the person. They were about the rights of the person to resist the coercion of the state directly. So it was incredibly more fundamental than economic freedom. But I do think, so I think there's both an instrumental and a direct effect of economic freedom. I think if you have economic freedom, you have more freedom. And I'm a big believer in freedom and liberty of human beings, because I think it feeds into their dignity and their respect and other access aspects of what people as human beings want purposes, and they want to be able to fulfill their purposes. And I think the more economic freedom you have, the more freedom you can have. So I think that's probably instrumental. I haven't personally measured it, but I would be very surprised if that weren't true.
So that gives us a good segue into what we want to next discuss with you, is the aid effectiveness general. Okay. So because I haven't seen a lot of aid agencies with the agenda of promoting economic freedom in any country. Why, if the evidence exists out there, what aspect about, you know, do you think development aid in itself is very, very effective in the way it's being administered at the moment? We would like your take on that.
So I have a peculiar, I think, stance on development agencies in general. I worked for the World Bank for a long time, and I felt within the World Bank I was able to do some good things. And so I'm not a bitter ex-employee. but that said, I'm close friends and sympathetic with Angus Deaton and Bill Easterly and others that take a pretty harsh view. And I do think the aid institutions have made lots of mistakes. I think they have underestimated the role of what we could call economic freedom in providing higher productivity and higher prosperity, and overplayed the role of state planning, in part because that was the instrument the World Bank had. I mean, the only instrument the World Bank was an amazingly narrow institution. It literally, the only thing it could do was lend money to governments. That was its only instrument. It was only debt. They couldn't take equity positions. They weren't a general financial institution. And the debt had to be guaranteed by the sovereign power. And so naturally, they tended to see their client as the government. And that naturally led to, a state preference. But I just wrote a paper that got published maybe just 6 months ago. So I'm not thinking anyone should have read it. But it's called Development Happened, Did Aid Help? And then in the first sentence of that paper, say the punctuation of the title is everything. Development happened, period. Did aid help? Question mark. So I think we want to start from, because I think a lot of negativity about development aid starts from factually wrong premises. So if you look at Hans Rosling's work on factfulness, I think people in the West think that development failed. But, you know, if you ask people in the West whether poverty has gone up or down or stayed the same, a minority of people think it's gone down. The reality is it's gone down enormously. I do a lot of research in the field of education. The average years of schooling of a child and of an adult in the developing world in 1950 was 2 years, which meant most people didn't go to any school at all. And by 2010, it's 8. The expansion in schooling, an amazing historically transformative thing. It's happened in the development era. So if we think of the development era as the era in which people self-consciously went about thinking there was something called development and trying to promote it, in that development era, a ton of development happened. So I use the sports analogy, American sports. Bill Belichick and Tom Brady together as coach and quarterback won 6 Super Bowls. Now you can ask,
Was Bill Belichick as a coach more important? Was Tom Brady as a quarterback more important? Is it some symbiotic thing? But you don't start the debate about that on the premise they didn't win any Super Bowls. They won six. That's the fact.
That's an important fact to add to this picture, to those not from the United States.
So we want to start from the fact they did win Super Bowl. That's incontrovertible. So the point is, we want to start the aid debate from whatever happened and whatever caused it. We did have enormous progress around the world in development. And even though we can be disappointed with the economic growth because it wasn't rapid convergence, 2% per capita growth is an amazingly transformational thing over 50 years. Mm-hmm. So the average developing country that grew at the average rate, which is about 2% per capita, compounded, that is, I don't know, something like quadrupled GDP per capita. So, and that wasn't at the expense of not investing in human development. Schooling expanded massively. Now, the quality of learning is another debate we can get into. Health. I mean, child mortality just plummeted over this period. So all kinds of children that are alive today wouldn't have been alive at the mortality rates of the 1950s, 1960s. So we want to start from a factual premise of enormous progress around the world. Certainly there are basket cases like Somalia and DR and Democratic Republic of Congo, but the typical country did really quite well over this period across a huge array of dimensions. Okay, now. So I think sometimes the rhetoric starts, development aid must have failed because development failed. Well, that's just wrong. That's just wrong. You know, if your argument is development aid failed because if it had succeeded, we would have had development, you're just operating on wrong factual premises. Factually, the world's an enormously better place in terms of nearly every measure of human well-being than it was in 1950. And during that period, people self-consciously were trying to achieve national development on the premise mm-hmm. that would be the outcome. So we want to start from some sympathy to, hey, something worked here. Now, that said, I think I have this, like I say, strange, I call it the bird on the elephant theory of development, which is development. An organization like the World Bank created a forum, created a group of people who were self-consciously trying to do economic development and who debated issues of development. They debated, you know, is this good for GDP? Is this bad for GDP? Is this the right way to improve health? Is that way to help? And so you created national and global and regional kind of intellectual content and elites who were debating these questions on the premise these were worthy objectives. That, I feel, in and of itself could have had enormously powerful effects on the way people worked, on the way people thought, on the way political leaders saw themselves in the world. But that wasn't the development projects. The development projects that the World Bank did were being done. So they were the elephant. They were this huge visible part. But, you know, so I'm making this up maybe, but you know, there are these birds that sit on top of the elephant, and the birds can see further by sitting on top of the elephant, and they can call out and warn of predators. And the question, you know, I debate with my friend Bill Easterly, can you have the bird without the elephant? So the bird is kind of the global network of people that are concerned about these issues and working on these issues, and the think tanks and the discussions and the evidence, and the academics doing research, and I'm using data to argue this point, that creates, you know, a useful forum. And I think the bird has been very valuable. The elephant, it tramples things, it breaks fences, it does a lot of negative things. I'm not such a big fan of the elephant, but I think the idea that you could have the bird without the elephant might be wrong. And so I'm kind of a big fan of the elephant.
And development aid is also evolving, right? I mean, yeah. We have had structural adjustments programs of the IMF. They have failed on a massive scale. Yeah. IMF has learned its lessons. It really burnt its fingers. Yeah. The World Bank also made mistakes. And I guess what we can see is that as you say, a lot of academics, think tanks rely on analysis data that is generated by development aid agencies, but it's especially the World Bank.
And the World Bank is a kind of hub of
this.
Yeah, and I, you know, and so I guess I think another thing is I think in my bird and elephant model, the existing methods to evaluate aid don't really capture the phenomena. So there's two levels to that. I wrote a whole book about aid effectiveness when I was at the World Bank together with David Dollar. And we, you know, emphasized the failure of structural adjustment meant conditionality as an instrument of aid agencies wasn't, you know, we concluded the Beatles were right. Money can't buy you love. And if you really need governments to be committed to their own reform program, you can't, you know, we kept talking about needing ownership of governments of the reform program. And we kept saying, you can't buy ownership because if you buy it, you own it. And then if you don't buy it, they own it. And so anyway, so first of all, a lot of the evidence about aid assumes that you can judge the effect of aid through the effect of aid projects. Did aid projects succeed or fail? But first of all, money's fungible. So, you know, if the World Bank funded this particular highway, you know, they might have funded the worst highway because the government wanted them, the World Bank, to work on it because they it was problematic. Or the government could have given the World Bank the best project so it would look good. So there's no way of going with fungibility of money. There's no way of looking at the bank's portfolio and the success or failure of its portfolio and judge whether the World Bank had a positive impact. Because you have to do the counterfactual of what would have happened without the World Bank assistance, not the factual of what the bank financed. So most of the literature on aid effectiveness that relies on project things is at best marginally relevant to the question of did foreign assistance or the development industry or whatever help or not help the development process over the last historical period.
It reminds me a little of what you said earlier about the different processes of national development and human flourishing. Here we have economic development or human development. We have development aid. And in a way, we can add a third process, and that is social welfare programs in the country.
Yeah.
So they all evolve on their own. They're interrelated. There is some way of influencing each other, but they are distinct processes.
They are distinct.
Because development aid does not lead to a country developing in itself. That's not possible.
I definitely think you can't imagine. I mean, and neither should it, right? If you said, you know, development aid in whatever form and mediated in whatever way really could be directly responsible for national success, that would be colonialism. That would, you know, that would be too much power. And I don't think anybody wants those agencies to have that much power anyway. So at best, it can facilitate it. And I think the way to think about it is how have development agencies been successful or not successful in facilitating a global environment in which countries had development success? And again, my weird compromise is I think the existence of a development industry has by and large been a pretty positive factor. And, you know, one way to look at it is, well, if you look at the countries that walked away and never participated in the global community and in the process of aid, did they do distinctly better? Well, that's kind of North Korea, Myanmar. It's not like you have this shining success of, look, we rejected engagement with the world process of development and succeeded. Aren't many really success cases of that type either. That said, the true success cases were always nationally driven, and the World Bank and others might have been facilitators in national leaders coming to correct decisions, might have provided data whose analysis led people to new ideas, might have provided a forum, but they didn't drive the development process.
That presents a very benign picture of development aid so far. But so let me come to you from an aid recipient country perspective, where we are trying to fight for more accountability from the government.
Yeah.
And please help explain, if you can explain this if there's a development framework out there for us to look at it from that perspective.
Yeah.
So once you have a development aid agency,
yeah,
and it's just not the bank only or one specific institution, yeah, so it's just considered the whole industry as a whole.
Yeah.
And so once you have that, entering and providing aid via the government,
yeah,
it removes a layer of accountability, or with that responsive polity you were talking about. And so I feel like if it has been successful in terms of effectively delivering development, it really depends then on state capacity, which means already a given level of state capacity exists where aid is effective. Whereas if you're working with already a weak governance system,
right,
then does it do more harm in terms of removing that connection with the responsive polity?
It definitely can do harm. And I think in aid-dependent countries, I think there's pretty good evidence that at very high levels of aid, because let's say aid gets to be 10%, 20% of GDP, which happens in very poor and usually small countries, then it completely distorts the political process. I mean, the African scholar Nick van der Waal pointed out that in precisely the period in which Africa was vastly underperforming on national development on all fronts, it also got a ton of aid, and it also tended to have more political stability than other regions of the world. And he said to point out, that's kind of a paradox that you have poor performance in delivering on human flourishing and political stability, and these high levels of aid's probably facilitated, as, you know, in some sense, there's a good question, is aid like oil, right? If aid is a source of rents that can be captured and funneled exclusively through state apparatus without any input, and it's not a responsive polity and a capacity state to start with, then easily aid can help, you know, elites stay in power where they wouldn't have without that exogenous funding from abroad. So I think there are dangers of harm for sure. I personally preferred to work on civilizations where there was no question of aid dependency. India, I worked for years in India. The Indians were the first to tell us that we had no power or influence over the Indian. And it's true, India's a 1,000-year-old civilization. We weren't, you know, really huge causal agents except as transmitter. I mean, except as birds to say, you know, you should look at what they're doing over there. And, you know, okay. That said, I think for smaller countries and more aid-dependent countries, the channel of accountability, well, you know, accountability kind of follows money. And so it was easy for governments to feel they were accountable for use of resources to the aid agencies at the expense of developing truly democratic mechanisms. And, you know, a lot of what I have tried to work on at various times is how can we, as aid development agencies, help governments build capability rather than exploit its existing capability or undermine its capability. So, you know, when I was working in India, I worked a lot on local government and local governance issues. And I would point out that, you know, oftentimes aid agencies set up pipelines to deliver money that actually channel around the normal mechanisms of government. And I was always pointing out that was a dangerous, you know, process of, you know, we would create, and in the interest often of project participation, you know, we would create local community groups that would then, you know, be channels through which we would funnel resources. And I was like, you know, there's a locally elected government here. Why are we not using that process? And my colleague Scott Guggenheim in Indonesia had a very, you know, I think, well thought through World Bank project where they used governmental processes to channel block grants to localities over which they had broad menu control in order, and the purpose of the project was not just to do the projects, but encourage the process of deliberation, encourage the process of accountability, encourage. And so they would build processes of accountability and processes of debate and deliberation into the project within a governmental structure, not as a parallel NGO or, you know, donor pipeline mechanism, but into the governmentality of the government itself. And those processes gradually became more and more routine within the government. So that would be a good example where, with a thoughtful vision of national development as requiring more responsive polities and more state capability, you regard it as an output of the project that enhanced capability rather than just we delivered so many, you know, the banks and other organizations often take accountability in a very narrow sense of, you know, here's how many wells we dug, or here's how many toilets we built, or here how many schools we built, independent of the processes that were followed and whether we were strengthening in the long run national development or not. So, yes, huge risks and demonstrable downsides. I mean, there are countries in which the donors kept governments alive that were just awful.
I'd like to take this conversation more into the context now of development aid. So what we have, I would say in the 70s, 80s, there was a certain commitment by Western societies saying we need to help. Yeah. We need to have a certain percentage of our revenues shared with the developing world. And now the discussion is changing. So in the United States, there's more and more a feeling like, why are we there if we're not welcome? In Europe now, the situation is economic hardship is hitting Europe at the moment. So big example was in Germany when they found out that a certain amount of money was spent on bicycle lanes in Peru. That became a massive discussion point. Why are we taxpayers paying for bicycle lanes in Peru? So in a way, there's a bit of a shift, a more critical shift towards development aid in the West. But at the same time, you also have a discussion in the recipient countries where, in a way, you know, you want to be there to send a signal with development aid and other things that we're here.
Yeah.
We care.
Yeah.
And that is an intangible aspect here that is important in development aid. How do you see this? Is this a necessary signal? Is it even possible to say we stop development aid because the recipient countries would see this as a hostile, almost hostile move?
Well, I mean, this is a parody of what academics say, but I've written a paper about this because I do think the development process lost its way when it lost its commitment to national development. And I think in the 2000s, because of the domestic political weakness of the commitment to development in the post-Cold War world, development agencies moved away from a vision of national development more towards the idea that you could, through some direct intervention of donor projects, affect directly human development, the measures of human flourishing. And hence, you began to see the idea that it was the direct impact, say, on a very narrow metric of poverty that was the way you were going to judge development. And I think that was a massive historical mistake that has led us to the situation where, you know, Ghana gets like $1 billion a year in development assistance, and the democratically elected government of Ghana has as part of its political platform that they want to end aid. Now, I think, how bad do you have to screw up before countries say, you're bringing $1 billion, but no thanks, we don't want it? You have to have made yourself pretty unpopular. And I think that's the countries are literally walking away from, you know, not loans, but actual grant mechanisms, suggests that they've lost confidence of the country, of the people in the country doing national development, that they're really helping. Mm-hmm. And I think that has a couple of aspects. One, I think when donor agencies move to narrow and narrower metrics based more and more on what their northern, western, whatever we want to call it, recipients wanted, they became less relevant to the national project of the country. And I think
eventually countries were just like, look, here is our list of priorities, and you say we're development partners, but I don't see you contributing to our partners either intellectually or rhetorically or through your financing. So
can you share some examples to make it a little clearer? So national development programs versus human flourishing programs. What I hear is labor standards, social standards, environmental standards.
Yeah, but I just think, I think rather than focusing on economic growth more broadly and say we're going to invest in physical infrastructure that facilitates growth because that's seen as a constraint to growth versus, projects targeted to the ultra poor. I want to make the distinction between, there's a big difference between mitigating the consequences of the lack of national development. And when countries do lack national development, lots of people suffer hardship in lots of ways. They lack education, they lack water and sanitation, they might be malnourished. And so it's really tempting to focus directly on, in some sense, what are the symptoms of a lack of national development and not work on national development. But if you go all that way, you ignore the fact that what's really going to help people solve many of their problems is having higher incomes. And the way you have higher incomes is not just by you becoming more productive, but by working in a more productive country. So actually broad-based economic growth is the solution to many of the direct symptoms of a lack of national development. And like I say, it's not just the social standards, which we can, that's another, I think, separate issue. It's the content of the project. And so, for instance, I did a big 8-year research project on basic education and the quality of the basic education K-12 kind of around the world. And, a lot of the donor programs wanted to focus on interventions to prevent girls from dropping out as adolescents. Fine, I got no ideological beef with that. But in those countries, half of children weren't learning to read by the time they hit grade 6. And I was like, look, if you're not effective for everybody, you can't differentially teach girls to read and not boys. And so there's systemic issues. And to the extent that all of donor assistance is channeled into what are perceived as marginalized groups, you can't also simultaneously help the country with the systemic issues. And so even within a field like basic education, it's, are we really, as outside donors and the bird, setting a global environment in which we're focusing on broad-based learning outcomes, or are we setting a global environment in which focus on, maintaining enrollment of girl adolescents is not just one of the issues, it's the issue, right? And I think, again, as a pro, as a development economist, I think we wondered, if you can't fix the fundamental quality issues in your education system with the assistance and support from the rest of the world in providing ideas and evidence and support, then the development endeavor becomes less and less relevant to the people that correctly envision what would be good for the country. And you draw scarce resources of the people who can think and do and implement in the country away from national priorities towards donor priorities. So, and then you lose support, essentially. The elites see what's happening and they just think this overall development process isn't really benefiting our country. It's benefiting the narrow targeted needs that appeal to, voters in the West. But if what you can give us via your political support from donors of the West is so irrelevant to our domestic needs, then let's just end the whole deal.
Well, I'm not even sure what my next question is provocative. I'm asking it anyway. So are the Chinese getting it right with their Belt and Road Initiative, focus on infrastructure? Are they getting it right?
Well, no, I one time had a a very high-ranking development government official who was thinking about Chinese development strategy for development 10 years ago come to me and say, I just don't understand. Why the hell isn't the World Bank building roads in Africa? And I was like, man, that is a complex story. So on some level, yes, the Chinese got it right. On another level, they got several things wrong, which every novice at development gets wrong. Every novice at development comes in, they look around, they see the country lacks stuff that rich countries have, and say, they need this stuff. And they don't realize that the existence or not of the stuff is, and I'll use the technical word economists use, the endogenous. That's a symptom, not the problem. Mm-hmm. So again, the reason why there aren't more highways in Africa is in part lack of investment. It's part lack of maintenance. And maintenance is a fiscal issue of how are you going to collect revenue so that when you need to maintain the highway, you can maintain the highway. So the capital expense of building the road is not the issue. The issue is, can we build a road together with organizations and norms and practices that maintain the road, including collecting from the users of the road or someone the necessary revenue to maintain the road? So the Chinese are, in some sense, right that what countries need and want is good roads. I think they are now exactly where you would expected they would be of having given lots of debt-financed infrastructure without adequate attention to their maintenance and use, and now you're having essentially the same debt crisis the World Bank had in the 1980s. Because structural adjustment didn't come full-blown out of nowhere. It came out of the fact that, again, the World Bank had lent too much to countries on the stuff-centric theory that the lack of stuff was their cause, it was the physical manifestation of something that could be fixed in a cocooned way. If you don't have a road, we can build you a road. But if you don't have a road, you have to ask, why don't you have a road? And a long, long time ago, I was working in Tanzania, and Tanzania in 1990 had roughly the same usable road infrastructure that it had had in 1970. In the interim, the donors had spent $2 billion building roads. So it wasn't, building roads is like, what could be easier? Let's build some friggin' roads so we can have the, we're looking out on a highway out this window behind you. Let's build some roads so people can transport goods and that'll facilitate a flourish. Da, da, da. But again, you have to be national development sensitive. Are we building organizations capable of maintaining these roads and planning these roads? And if you build the physical infrastructure without the corresponding, I hesitate to use the word institutional because it's overly broad and too abstract, but without the organizational and human capability in the country to maintain the roads, you're just setting yourself up for... There was a joke at the time that foreign aid was just... anticipated foregone depreciation.
Kind of makes sense, though.
It's like, the purpose is a little harsh, but I think had something to it. And I think the Chinese are now learning that building the road was the easy part.
Yeah. Let me get that. So listening to all that conversation we've just had, what comes to me again is, it looks like there is a structural problem within the development aid industry itself.
Oh, absolutely.
So in the way it approaches development and so on and so forth. Yeah. So why haven't development economists, instead of focusing on what brings on development, worked a little bit on how do we restructure this industry that we're able to grasp. So I'll give you an example. Like, the latest fad in development aid, at least in our part of the world, is spending on entrepreneurship now.
Yeah.
It's all, the whole focus has been on entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And it sort of, you know, reminds me, like, oh, that was one area that you guys hadn't touched so far and was working fine.
Yeah.
So now are we, you know, anticipating something of a backlash in terms of entrepreneurship programs?
I think it's incredibly worse than that. From my point of view, as someone who has spanned, you know, kind of the World Bank and academia, I think development economists, and in particular the movement around randomized controlled trials, has biased the questions we can ask as a profession and that are rewarded with publication in journals and professorships, away from the big national development questions like, what's the interaction between economic growth and state capability? Is it positive? Is it negative? Does one pattern of growth undermine state capability? Is one pattern of growth too dependent on state capability that doesn't really exist and we should be more market? These big questions that, you know, national leaders and need to grapple with are getting zero help from the enormous, from the, if you say, who would you go to for wisdom and prudence and guidance about big questions like that, it's disappeared in favor of the kind of, so the development industry's instinct to, in defensive mode against the loss of political support, move to more concrete, demonstrable, attributable outcomes that were popular, that led to a more enhanced attention to the elephant and less attention to the bird. And then the randomistas come along and say, oh, but, you know, along with your package to do this particular concrete thing with attributability, we will only be able to give you a stamp of attributability if you know causation, and you can only know causation if you do as an experiment. And so it was like the old story of the drunk guy's driving down the highway and he sees a guy underneath a spotlight kind of looking around, so he stops to help. And they're looking under the, you've heard this story, you're looking under the spotlight for the keys to the car. And then the guy goes, well, where did you lose them? He said, oh, I lost them way over there in the dark, but there's no light over there, so I'm looking here under the light. And it's like the randomistas came, found people looking under the light where the real problems weren't anyway, and said, let's take this to my office where we have even better light and a microscope to look at this. And it's like, no, that's not helping. So I think the projectized bias of aid has been problematic overall. And so I think I feel we're coming back to a realization that the development industry discourse, including economics and including development academia, moved away from big important questions that developing countries need to answer and need to have the best guidance you can give, even if it's not rigorous, altogether. And then therefore, you know, projects on entrepreneurship are sort of in this sea of competing projectized things. And I think, you know, to some extent, the emphasis on entrepreneurship is counsel of despair. It's like, we don't have any idea how to generate jobs, so you're not going to find a job, so let's teach you how to survive on your own and call it entrepreneurship. Like, wow, that is just the worst bullshit in the world. It's like, we're trivializing your problem of living in a country that isn't, you know, generating enough jobs so that most people make a living in the rich world by having a job, but we can't find you a job, so we'll teach you how to serve, you know, how to, like, you know, push a little cart around the street and serve some people breakfast and call it entrepreneurship. That is not, like, the solution to anybody's problem. So, again, I think this faddishness, this kind of small project-mindedness, I think is a consequence. And I don't think, you know, the crazy thing is you don't see development academics saying, whoa, why aren't we focused on these bigger questions of
you know, what are the conditions under which Nepal can generate employment for its people at productive, at, you know, rising wages and in a productive way? And do we have the right theories? Do we have the right evidence? Can we give you some wisdom and judgment and have a discourse around that? They're like, oh, you want to do an entrepreneurship problem? Let's build a randomized controlled trial on top of it and see if it works. 3 years later, you spend $1 million and find out it doesn't work. It's like, so it's worse than that. I don't I think the worst tendencies of development to move to projectized away from national development questions is being reinforced rather than fought by academia.
Before we conclude the discussion, I would like you to take a look in a crystal ball. And I'm wondering, you know, with the development that's happening, poverty is coming down, as you say, tremendously. Is the development industry a sunset industry? You know, is this a discussion? Because I see Thailand withdrew, they don't need it anymore. Malaysia withdrew. Indonesia will soon, in one way or another, fall out of all of this.
Believe it or not, we're also graduating the middle-income countries. So.
It's happening in many countries. And so is it a sunset industry? Do we believe it's be over anytime soon?
I think if it continues in its current pathologies, yes, it's a sunset industry. It is finding itself hard to defend either in its home country or abroad. I think part of this was a reduction of its ambition in the interests of getting core support, Ashley, was at the expense of relevance. So I just recently completed a paper about the dollar a day poverty line was a massive, tragic, misguided step because it defined an unbelievably low threshold as supposedly the objective of development, which was just ridiculous. The, you know, if you ask, we're in India, if you would have asked Nehru what the objective of development, he would see properly that eliminating dollar a day poverty was a milestone. On our way to development, we will go by this mileage marker saying you've eliminated dollar a day poverty, but it's not the destination. We're not there. And so I think the paradox of the world is far from developed. If you look at access to electricity, access to sanitation, access to reliable water, access to rule of law, access to justice, access to quality education, the world is just unbelievably far from meeting some pretty basic goals. So, and yet, the development industry has made itself irrelevant to that process. So, a pithy way I put it is, either the dollar a day dies or development dies. If development continues to insist on its narrow, faddish, projectized, Western-driven modalities, it will die and probably deserves to die, because if it wasn't relative to the priorities of the countries that needed it, it should die. That said, I think that would be a bad thing because we would lose the bird. You know, we would lose an ability for think tanks in Nepal and Indonesia to have a community. Who would they talk to, right? What structures the global discourse about how to collect more tax revenue? What structures the discourse on how to improve quality education? How are we going to maintain discussions that aren't dominated completely and entirely by the experience of the global North and West if there isn't something that a self-conscious movement called development? So I very much hope that the development movement can see that it headed down a cul-de-sac. The beautiful thing about a cul-de-sac is it has a space to turn around and they can re-engage, you know, because I think if development can't be relevant to Indonesia, it's badly lost its way. I lived in Indonesia 24 years ago. It still has enormous development issues across a whole variety of ways. They're not first generation or maybe even second generation, but they're not Denmark. They're still a very long way from the vision of participating as full equals in the global sphere, of, you know, adequately fulfilling the legitimate aspirations to human flourishing that Indonesians have. And if the development industry can't address the problems of Nepal and Indonesia, it deserves to die. I think it can reformulate itself, but it needs to self-consciously re-examine where it is and what it's doing. And if it doesn't, it will die, because it's just, it's a, you know, it's irrelevant. I mean, I had a friend of mine arrange, if you talk to global leaders, I just don't feel like they feel, even the World Bank, which is a broad-based partner, is really helping them with the problems. And I was talking to a country director in an African country just a few weeks ago, and he was saying when they do try and address those problems, other donors criticize them. You know, when they take on the kind of more fundamental issues of state capability rather than implementing specific projects, it's like, why aren't you spending more of your money on this identifiable fad? And they're like, because somebody has to mind the nitty. Somebody has to help the government of this African country actually with its overall development processes. And since you guys are rushing into all these fads, it has to be us. Which is not a popular thing to say, I'm sure, but it's reality.
Landon, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Brilliant conversation. We all together.
It gave us lots of food for thought, yeah. And our audience certainly also appreciated that. We want to really thank you for your time. Thank you for talking to us today.
Happy to be here. I'm a development lawyer. I will talk development anywhere, anytime.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm still digesting all the things that Land has shared with us, Arpita. There were so many interesting insights. Shall I kick it off?
Yes, please, because I'm slowly processing them.
All right. So to start with, I thought it was helpful, extremely helpful, to by his way of clearly differentiating between national development and human flourishing, that we need to look at them separately, but that doesn't mean they are independent from each other or not related to each other. But these are two distinct processes that we need to analyze with different indicators and ways of measuring.
That's very true. I think having been very critical of the development aid industry in general, I think I've forgotten. It was a good reminder to think about what's the agenda of development. And the way he put it, this is national development. Here are four different areas that we need to think about. And that was a very key moment for me to think back onto why, you know, how the development discourse started. So bringing that into perspective and having a very good working definition was very helpful.
And then, of course, from a liberal perspective, the question would be, how does individual freedom and in particular economic freedom come into the equation? Because, of course, we're looking for causalities always. We want to see what's the solution that triggers human flourishing. So causality matters. And in a way, there are certain causalities between national development and human flourishing. He reiterated that. But then there's also the question of what actually causes national development. And we heard from him that he has a very strong belief in the necessity for economic freedom.
That's true. Another very important point. And then we moved on to talking about the effectiveness of aid. And I think it was a very balanced take in the sense that we can't say that development hasn't delivered anything, because there has been development in the world as long as the development industry has been around. And I think his counterfactual was very poignant for me, was say, okay, which are the countries that chose not to participate in this process? And let's look at them as examples. Would you like to be like North Korea, for example, right, who chose not to participate in this process? So if you look at it that from that lens, it was very interesting. But he emphasized the state capacity. And that, to me, is another very, very important. As an economist, you always think about, yes, exactly, you want a responsive polity, but a responsive polity can only be created when you have corresponding state capacity to a large extent. And maybe that's where the investment should have happened for a longest time in development aid. So that was a very, very interesting insight for me.
And then we spoke about the context, right? So we spoke about, you know, how is development aid perceived in the populace, but also how is development aid executed. And when we discussed this topic, he shared with us how much he saw it as a mistake, as a grave mistake, when development aid actually abandoned the focus on national development, for example, supporting infrastructure, and moving on to actually trying to have a direct impact on human flourishing, when it actually tried to target directly the beneficiaries, you know, when it actually interfered with individual people's lives, which caused, I guess, frictions with these groups, but also with the national governments. Whereas in his opinion, it would have been better had it stayed, had the development aid stayed on the national development track and had a bigger picture look and not went into these small projects. And of course, I asked him about whether China then does it better. And interestingly, in a way, China has this focus, but then it's debt financed. And when the roads are not properly maintained, and thereby, at one point there is more fiscal power necessary to maintain them, China will experience a similar situation as what the West has done, that in the end, then they will not have that pet debt repaid. And so China might be on a better track with their focus on infrastructure, but they will also run into trouble, according to Lan's opinion.
True. And finally, I think one thing that stuck with me was the discussion about the development industry as it is set up right now and as it is operated right now. And I think one of the key takeaways is Lan's opinion that it is a sunset industry if it continues on its path, where academics are not addressing the most important questions about development, and practitioners are way too focused on individual projects, whereas these larger questions remain unanswered, and therefore creating another level of interference whose impact we actually don't know, because there is not enough long-run studies to actually tell us, you know, what the long-run impact of such intervention is at the end of the day. So to me, that was a very, very important takeaway, that the development industry as a whole needs to rethink its role. Otherwise, it is on a track to pretty much, you know, becoming irrelevant.
And this concludes our episode today on Unpacking Development. And we hope you will stay tuned for other interesting episodes of the podcast of the International Academy for Leadership. Goodbye for today.
Bye-bye.